Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Access to Access, also known as A2A. This is your weekly opportunity to participate in a webinar where you, the turdite, get to submit questions to the movers and shakers in the metal industry. And boy, do we have a mover and shaker. Actually, Brent, you're mainly a mover and shaker because you live in San Francisco, where the ground moves and shakes all the time.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't move anytime soon.
We need a little terra firma for the next half hour or so, so we'll keep our fingers crossed. I've got Brent Johnson on the line here. Brent, this guy I consider to be a good friend. He is a money manager in a sense. He's a CEO of Santiago Capital in San Francisco. He's the founder of the Santiago Gold Fund. You're probably familiar, if you hear that voice, you've seen his presentations, fantastic presentations that he cranks out, usually 8-9 minutes at a time. They're picked up often by Zero Hedge. Just does a great job of informing and educating the wider investment community. And so it's great to count him as a friend and great to have him here at TIFFMR. Brent, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
No, absolutely. I appreciate you inviting me on. Looking forward to talking to you guys.
Well, my friend, I thought we would start with a real basic question because I had Dave Krantler on last week and out of Denver, and Dave also runs a hedge fund. And I got off the line and I was thinking to myself about how much stuff we all take for granted, the terms we bandy around. Like you know, one time I was talking about yield on the treasury being in basis points. And I thought, you know, that's a industry term that everybody understands, but the regular guy – you know, that's so anyway, I thought, well, let's start with the term hedge fund, Brent. I figured no one better than you to explain to everybody what the heck a hedge fund, what does that term even mean? And who invests in these things?
Right. So, the term hedge fund came from kind of the original investment vehicles that started back in, I think, the 60s and 70s. And that's what they were called, hedged funds. So it had a D behind it. So, and they called them that because they went long and short. So they were somewhat hedged, quote unquote, versus the market. Now, over the years, that has, you know, developed into a huge industry of its own. And now saying the word hedge fund, it's a little bit like saying car. I mean, it's just a vehicle is all it is. It's an investment vehicle. But, you know, if I said, you know, we're going to ride in that car, you know, that could mean anything from a Volkswagen Bug to a Lamborghini, right? And, you know, there's not, other than they both have four wheels, there's not a little lot of similarity between a Volkswagen and a Lamborghini. So, you know, you really need to dig down underneath that and realize that, you know, hedge fund, the word hedge fund gets lumped into all kind of articles and, you know, research reports, et cetera, talking about the hedge fund. But that, again, they're lumping potentially two dramatically different things or many dramatically different things into one category that may or may not be correct. So, you know, just think of a hedge fund as an investment vehicle. You know, there's mutual funds, there's stocks, there's bonds, and then there's hedge funds. And it's just another way to get exposure to an investment class. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what it is. Now, the thing that's a little bit different is that hedge funds are typically, well, I guess mainly they're private partnerships. So they come in limited partnership, you know, structures. And so when you invest in a hedge fund, you're becoming a limited partner with all the other investors that are in that vehicle. And so you're essentially buying equity in a company that company then goes and invests in a certain market type. Now there's fixed income hedge funds, there's equity hedge funds, there's precious metals hedge funds, there's credit derivative hedge funds. So again, I mean, you know, a credit derivative hedge fund has absolutely zero resemblance to a real estate hedge fund, right? So, you know, again, they can be dramatically different, even though they're both classified as hedge funds. I don't know if that helps explain it or not, but happy to dig into that deeper if you want.
And in terms of a traditional investing, where an open-ended mutual fund or an ETF or something is going to be long only and in specific asset classes, a hedge fund can pretty much take either side of a bet and bet on.
That's right. And some hedge funds do and some hedge funds don't. And that's where the name has gotten a little bit, I don't know, bastardized, if that's the right way to say it. You know, there's a lot of hedge funds out there, specifically equity hedge funds that are really levered long and have very little hedge on them, even though they're quote unquote classified as hedge funds. So, you know, if you're ever taking a look at a hedge fund or you're reading about a hedge fund, they start talking, you really want to dig down into what that hedge fund does and what their strategy is and what market they're into and how they're approaching that market. Again, maybe they might be levered long in that strategy, or they may be levered short in that strategy. And, you know, long story short, you can't just read the word hedge fund and think you know what they're talking about.
Right, right. And just so everyone knows, I mean, that's just part of what Brent does. Brent's also just a traditional money manager. And so I know I get asked, gosh, I probably get an email a month at least from someone that is, you know, their stockbroker, their financial planner or whatever, just doesn't get it. You know, they talk about gold and they look at you like you're some kind of fruitcake for even suggesting gold or a gold mining share in your portfolio. And so they're looking for an investment advisor in the traditional sense that does get it. Well, Brent obviously does. And that's part of what you do too, right, Brent?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this will kind of even lead in a little bit to how I even got into gold to begin with.
Yeah, please.
You know, for several years, I was working for a firm called Credit Suisse and their high net worth group out here in San Francisco. And I loved it. It was kind of my dream job. And, you know, in that job, long story short, we were advising, you know, wealthy individuals and families on their overall portfolios. And, you know, I really enjoyed that. You know, I met a lot of incredible people and incredibly smart people and got to know them and, you know, was lucky enough to have them trust me to manage their money. But I really grew disenfranchised with Wall Street. Anybody that's seen my presentations in the last couple of years knows that I, you know, have a very, I guess, dismal view of traditional Wall Street. And that view comes from the fact that I spent, you know, a decade in there and I kind of seen it from the inside out. And it doesn't mean that everybody that works on Wall Street is a bad guy. It just means that the system itself is bad. And even if you're doing everything with altruistic purposes, if the system is bad and the incentives are bad, you know, bad things are going to happen. And that's my biggest criticism for Wall Street. And so I finally got to a point, even though I kind of had my dream job, that I couldn't hardly stand to walk through the doors anymore.
Yep.
And so I decided to make a change. And I joined a buddy of mine who had started his own firm for a lot of the same reasons, because he was very critical of Wall Street as well. And so, you know, I left Credit Suisse in 2000, at the beginning of 2010, and joined him at a firm called Baker Avenue Asset Management, where we do traditional, you know, stocks, bonds, you know, commodities, diversified, you know, wealth management, helping people coordinate their trust and estate plan with their CPA, all that kind of stuff. It just so happens that as part of that overall financial management, I was of the belief that gold was not only an important part, but a critical part of that overall wealth management piece. And I didn't want to do it through an ETF. I didn't want to do it through a mutual fund, et cetera, et cetera. I thought we needed to own the real physical gold. And so I set up as a separate legal entity from, you know, the traditional wealth management, Santiago Capital, which is focused solely on precious metals. And so then my clients, their precious metal allocation goes into Santiago, whereas the rest of their investment allocation goes into Baker Avenue Asset Management. So that's kind of the genesis of it. And if you want me to get into a little bit more detail of why I wanted to do that, I can do that as well. But that's kind of who I am and kind of how I got to be here, I guess.
Well, and I do think it'd be interesting. Explain to people what drove your interest in gold. We've all gotten here from one direction or another, you know, whether we think that the current system is unsustainable, you know, whether we expect a dollar to devalue to nothing or, you know, or be split off into international dollar, lose reserve currency status, all that kind of stuff. How did you join the party, Brent? How did you get to where you are?
Well, it really started back in 2007, and I'll try to make this short. I could make this very long, but I'll try to make it short. Long story short is I met a couple who had started a video game company out of their dorm room at Harvard and sold it for, you know, 20 or 30 million bucks. And my job was to, you know, pitch guys like that and women like that to for us at Credit Suisse to manage their money. And so I went and met with them, and we kind of hit it off. And I said, well, why don't you come back into come meet the whole team back at the office, and, you know, you can, you know, kick the tires and meet the experts and figure out, you know, why we should be managing your money. And so they did that. And we came in and we're sitting in our conference room on the, you know, 32nd floor overlooking San Francisco Bay. And I've got, you know, the head of equities and the head of the West Coast. And I've got our investment, you know, the strategist there, you know, and these are big shots at the firm. You know, these guys are our top guys. And you know, we start giving them the pitch about, you know, why Credit Suisse and why we should be managing their money. And they just start asking very simple questions. You know, what's the credit default swap? What's the derivative? You know, how many do you have on your balance sheet? You know, what do you think is the real rate of inflation? What do you think about the national debt? You know, not crazy questions, just very thoughtful, smart questions. And these guys couldn't answer any of them. And you know, honestly, I mean, I remember sitting in that meeting thinking, oh, we're going to knock this out of the park. And about halfway through, I realized that not only are we knocking it out of the park, but we're striking out on every question they throw us, right? And so the meeting ends and they leave, and you know, I could tell that they weren't ever going to become clients. The funny thing is that they actually did later become some clients for another reason. But you know, I go back into the meeting to kind of recap, and these managing directors are sitting around laughing, and I said, well, what's so funny? And they're like, oh, these young kids, they make a bunch of money, they think they know everything. They're sitting around waiting for the world to end. They needed to give us their money and let us manage it. And I was thinking, you know, that can't be the right answer. You couldn't even answer their question. So I'll never forget this. I went back to my office and I was sitting at my desk. And, you know, the reality is I didn't know the answers to their questions either.
Right.
And so, you know, I got out a piece of white paper and a pencil and I went on Google and I looked up the national debt and I wrote it all out longhand. So I wrote all the zeros down, you know, with a pencil. And then I looked up how much revenue we get off of taxes, and I wrote it down. And I looked up, you know, the budget deficit, and I wrote it down. And I started kind of doing all this math longhand just so I could actually see the numbers. And I quite literally had the light bulb above the head moment, you know, where it just all clicked. And I was like, holy shit, yeah. Yeah. This is bad news, right? And I didn't have all the answers yet. I just knew it was bad. And so that was the start of kind of the journey, you know, to really kind of understanding things. And so, you know, prior to that, we'd probably always had a small, you know, precious metals allocation, you know, 1 or 2%, you know, done through a mutual fund or an ETF or something. But, you know, as I'd always kind of had an interest in it because, you know, again, not to go too much of a tangent, but my dad had found this very valuable silver coin, you know, when he was metal detecting back in the early 80s. And, you know, this dime was now worth a couple thousand bucks. And I was trying to figure out, why is a dime worth a couple thousand bucks? So I'd always kind of had this interest in it a little bit. And so, you know, when I really started digging into this again, you know, pre-2008, and started reading a lot more, started, you know, going on blogs, because I couldn't ask my colleagues, right? Because they don't know the answer, nor did they want to know the answer. If you started talking too much about gold or national debt problems or whatever, you kind of got laughed at a little bit.
Right.
And so a lot of this was like self-discovery. And, you know, then I kind of come across the Austrian economic theory and I started getting books and reading about that. But anyway, that was kind of the progression that led me to, you know, realizing that gold needed to have a much bigger place in the portfolio. You know, then we get into 2008. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that I called the debt, the real estate crisis, because that would be incorrect, but I did kind of understand why it was happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't a shock to me and it wasn't surprising to me. And as a result, I kind of was able to navigate through it maybe better than a lot of other people, at least from a mental standpoint, because I wasn't at least trying to figure everything out. You know, I didn't have all the answers, but I wasn't totally in the dark either. And so that was kind of the progression. And I realized that, you know, gold should be a part of everybody's portfolio, not just because of the inflationary aspects. You know, central banks are going to print money, they're going to devalue the dollar, and, you know, gold should go up over time, same with housing or other real assets. But there's the counterparty risk as well. You know, when everybody's defaulting, even the AAA rated banks and even governments are defaulting, you need to have something that doesn't default. And so that was really how I came to gold, was more from the counterparty risk aspect as opposed to the inflationary aspect. I do think I think the traditional way that people come to gold, and I don't want to put words in other people's mouth or anything, and you know, not yours either, Turd, but you know, I think most people that kind of come into the gold world come into it from the inflationary aspect. You know, they realize that central banks are going to print money, they realize that over time fiat currencies are going to lose value. They realize that that's, you know, the playbook that central banks have used for hundreds of years to get their, you know, fiscally mismanaged governments out of debt is to inflate it away. And so, you know, they buy real assets, and part of that's gold or silver in order to protect them from a depreciating dollar. And, you know, the debts are so big that they're never going to be able to pay off, and the Fed's just going to keep printing money. We're going to have hyperinflation, and, you know, gold's going to go to 10,000. So I think that's the traditional meme. And I completely understand that. I do think that that's ultimately kind of where we will end up, is extremely high levels of inflation, central banks printing money, printing into oblivion, da 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 da. However, I actually believe that before that happens, that the dollar is going to go very much higher, much higher. And the reason I say that is I think that regardless of how much dollars have been printed, how much yen has been printed, how much euros have been printed, the amount of debt that has been issued kind of swamps the amount of currency that's been printed. And so I think that that debt is going to overrun that currency. And I think for the dollar not to get stronger from here, they need to print a lot more than they've already printed. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you look at the world and you think about what's the biggest danger to the world economy right now, and in my opinion, the biggest danger to the world economy is a strong dollar, because a strong dollar leads to massive dislocations in emerging markets, and specifically China.
Yep.
And that's why I think the most important ratio in global finance is the U.S. dollar Chinese yuan cross rate. There's been a lot of talk about this detente, central bank detente at the Shanghai meeting, in order to weaken the dollar. Well, why would they want to weaken the dollar? They'd want to weaken the dollar because a strong dollar would screw everybody completely, right? Not only would it hurt the United States and our ability to pay off the debt that we'll never be able to pay off, but since 2008, emerging markets have issued in dollar terms, I think it's $4.5 to $5 trillion worth of debt.
Jeez.
Now they did that with the thought that, hey, the dollar is going to, the U.S. is going to print a lot of dollars. It's going to debase the dollar. We will borrow in dollars. As they debase those dollars, our commodity-based currencies will appreciate, and our economies will grow faster because of this falling dollar. And so we will be able to pay off this dollar debt with our inflated currencies versus their, or our inflated markets versus their weakening dollar. Well, that all worked great until about 2012, when the dollar stopped appreciating depreciating. And then in 2014, it actually started appreciating, and it didn't just appreciate a little bit. It appreciated by 25%.
Yep.
And it took those numbers, that amount of debt that could never be paid off anyway, in normal terms, and increased it by 25%. So those countries, China included, let's just use the number $4 trillion as an example, right? Well, regardless of whether the dollar loses value or not, those loans have to be paid off in dollars. So that's $4 trillion of demand for dollars mm-hmm. that they need, right?
Yeah.
We need $19 trillion to pay off our debt. Now, obviously nobody's going to pay it off right away, so you don't exactly need $19 trillion today. So there's not necessarily demand for $19 trillion a day. But my point is that there is an underlying demand for dollars. The world is structurally short dollars. So, you always hear about these carry trades, right? A carry trade is when you sell one asset and you take the proceeds to go invest it somewhere else, right? Well, if you borrow, or if you issue a bond or whatever it is, you're basically selling those dollars, and you're taking the proceeds and you're going to invest in it somewhere else so that you think it's going to have a higher return. But those dollars have to be paid back. And in a slowing economy, those dollars become harder to pay back. But the demand is still there, right? The demand for the dollars is still there. Maybe the demand for the iron ore and the copper and the nickel and all the commodities is dropping because the economy is slowing, but the demand for dollars is still there because that debt is owed. So, and I think that's what was happening over the last couple of years. As the world economy was slowing, the demand for dollars was increasing. With China slowing, dollars were trying to get out of China. If you sell the yuan and you buy dollars, that pushes the dollar up, that pushes the yuan down. And so, and I think the fact that this detente, this currency detente between the central banks, whether it's true or not, I don't know. It certainly looks to be true. But whether it's true or not, the fact that it's given so much credence by very smart, very high-level people shows that the strong dollar was a very bad thing for the world economy. So that's kind of my – and at the end of the day, I think the central banks are going to lose, right? You got to realize the dollar getting weaker is the central banks winning, right? The Fed wants to weaken the dollar, right?
Right. And
if they print enough, they will weaken it. But I think that they will have to print more than they've already printed it to weaken it much further, because I think all the other currencies are in more trouble than the dollar. So I kind of got off on a rambling tangent there, but that's kind of, and you know, one last little point to that, and we can dig into it more if you want. I think that China is going to have to devalue their currency. Mm-hmm. And I can go into the reasons why that is, but I think they're going to have to devalue their currency. And, you know, if they do that, if the peg breaks and China has to devalue by 10 or 15%, kind of all bets are off. There's a very famous hedge fund manager named Hugh Henry, who runs a firm called Eclectica out of London. And he's kind of this, you know, very contrarian guy, marches to the beat of his own drum, but super smart guy. You know, he says if we wake up tomorrow and China has, you know, devalued their currency by 15 or 20%, he said the world's over. He said trade stops, you know, goods don't flow, you know, mass riots. Now, I don't necessarily agree to him to that extent, but I know what he's saying, because if China were to devalue by 15 or 20%, which I think they need to do, it will be an incredibly large deflationary event for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, you know, that who knows what happens. Now, I think ultimately that would be very good for gold, but in the 1 or 2 days after it happens, who knows what happens?
Yeah.
I mean, everything breaks. It's chaos, right? As people try to kind of figure it out. So, and in that chaos, I think people buy dollars. Now, I think they're wrong to buy dollars. I don't think that that's a good asset for them to go to. I think it's a very flawed asset, and it will ultimately lose all its value. But I still think that's where people will go.
Yeah.
Unless the system changes before that happens, I think that's where people will go. Now, they might go to gold as well. It's not necessarily a negative for gold, but I think it sends the dollar much higher. So anyway, that was kind of a long tangent, but that's kind of the reason I got into gold, and those are the kind of the big pressures I see out there today.
I think great stuff, and I appreciate you sharing all that with us, because I think it's extraordinarily informative. I think at this point, I'm just going to segue from here into some of the questions that we've already gotten piled up from the listeners. And again, if you have a question you'd like to ask Brent directly, this is your chance. There's a tab on your GoToWebinar control panel for questions. You just click that tab and you type it in. It comes straight to me and I relay it on to Brent. And Brent, the first question has to do with the gold-silver ratio. And we're all watching that and seeing that get to extremes. What do you make of the current gold-silver ratio? And in a bull market for the metals, how far would you expect that ratio to fall?
Well, I think right now it's a little bit below 80. I think it's between 75 and 80 right now, right? And it was a little bit higher than that earlier this year. Once we get in, and perhaps this is probably a good time to kind of get into this a little bit too. Once we get into the full bull market, now I think we're kind of at the early stages of it, but once, you know, whether it's 6 months or a year or 2 years, once we really get into the middle of the bull market, I think that comes down dramatically. You know, I think the number that's kind of bandied about, you know, from a natural perspective and a historical example is like, you know, 16 to 18 or something like that, which would indicate that silver has a much larger, you know, upside than gold from here. And I tend to agree with that. I do agree with that. I think that, you know, gold will do incredibly well in the years ahead. And I think, you know, silver to a certain extent is gold on steroids. Now, I've heard silver referred to as the devil's metal several times because you never know what it's going to do from this week to the next. And it is extremely volatile. And it doesn't quite have the same counterparty risk that gold has. So I still think that gold should be, you know, the anchor of your portfolio. But I do think, you know, anybody who has exposure to precious metals but doesn't have exposure to silver is kind of doing themselves a disservice. You know, it was kind of interesting earlier in this year, and this kind of ties back into what I was talking about earlier, is I'm not sure deflation is gone. I still think deflation is the number one risk out there for the world. I think we're in a stagflationary environment now where a lot of financial assets are appreciating because of all the fiat currency around the world that's been printed. But, you know, the economy is not expanding, or if it is expanding at extremely low rates. And all this debt overhang is, and the negative rate, which I don't think negative rates are inflationary. I actually think they're deflationary. So I think deflation is the big problem out there. So until that breaks and we get into a very obvious inflationary environment, I'm not sure if the gold-silver ratio goes much lower from here right now. It very well might, and I would be happy to be wrong on this. And if, you know, if if inflation here, and I just don't realize it yet, and, you know, we're off to the races, you know, I would expect to see that ratio come down a lot. And so I own silver. We have silver in our portfolio. We think it's an important part to have. But I'm not ready to say that, it's seen its high, and it's marching to 16 today. So I don't know if that answers the question or not.
No, it does. Hey, let me just follow up with a question of my own. I mean, you can look at that ratio and how it compares to historical norms going back millennia. Yeah, without even saying whether it has anything to do with price manipulation, is it at least just anything, a symptom of the lunacy, the fallacy of the paper derivative pricing scheme,
right,
that ratio could get so askew?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy that it's at this level to begin with, right?
Right.
But I think we live in a crazy world. And I think the world might get a little bit more crazy before it gets better. And in that craziness, you know, it wouldn't shock me to see it go from wherever, I think it's at 76 today, if it went back to 82 or 83 or even 90. It wouldn't, nothing after the last 3 years, nothing's going to surprise me anymore, right? I mean, if people are still surprised after living through the last 3 years, I don't know what to say to them.
Yeah. All right. Next question comes from Mike. We just want you to follow up on what you were discussing earlier about China and needing to devalue that peg of the yuan versus the dollar. And if you could just explain further why you feel that way.
Okay. So if you go back and you look at the dollar versus all these currencies, go back to the middle of 2014 till, into 2015, the dollar appreciated by like 25%. That's not such a bad deal, except for the Chinese currency was pegged, I guess I should say, to the dollar. And so as the dollar appreciated, the yuan appreciated along with it. Again, that's not such a bad thing, except for the fact that they're a big exporter to the rest of the world.
Right.
And, they're probably their biggest trade competitor is Japan. So over that time period where the yuan appreciated by 25% along with the dollar, the yen and the euro and, other currencies that are not pegged to the dollar depreciated, right? So now all of a sudden China has a slowing economy, they're in a credit crunch, and their exports are slowing down because their currency is appreciated by 25%. If you look at China's banking system, has over 30 trillion in assets. That's their bank assets, okay? The U.S. has like 18. 15 years ago, China had like 5 trillion. So in the last 10 or 15 years, they've they've extended $22 trillion, give or take a trillion, of credit. I mean, that is an incredible amount of money.
Good.
I mean, think about it. The U.S. has 18 to 20 trillion in bank assets. We've been doing this for 250 years. They've been doing it for 30 or 40, and they're already vastly surpassed us. They need to, in order for the numbers are just crazy. In order for China to meet their 2020 GDP growth goals, which I think is 6.5-7%, which is down dramatically from what it used to be, 12-13%. In order for them to meet those growth goals, based on the amount of GDP growth per dollar borrowed, they need to extend in the next 4 years another $23 trillion of credit on top of the $30 trillion that already exists.
Goodness gracious.
I think you've probably used this number before, but just so people that are real, 10 years ago, we didn't even use the word trillion. It was like a word out there that kind of everybody knew existed, but nobody ever said it because nobody ever got that high. And now here in the last, call it 6 or 7 years, we use trillion as if it's nothing. A trillion is a million million. A trillion is, if you lived to be a trillion seconds, you know how old you'd be?
How old?
32,000 years old. So, it's just, the numbers are, they're just stupid. The numbers are just ridiculous. There is no way. And people always say, well, if growth picks up, it's fine. You know what? If growth picks up, it's not fine. You're not paying off $50 trillion. You're just not. So long story short, you think about all the work that the U.S. Fed is doing to goose the dollar in order to get our, economy going. Well, China needs to do the same thing to get their economy going. And as long as they're shackled to the dollar, it's going to be very hard for them to do. Now they removed that peg at the end of the year. And, in the first couple of weeks of the year, you know, you saw these massive outflows from China of dollars trying to get out of China. And, you know, I can send you a whole presentation. I could speak for an hour on this topic alone. So what I can, I have a presentation that I can send out if you want me to, Craig, that will kind of talk about this in a little bit more detail. And then maybe, you know, people can view it and, you know, make what they want of it. And if they have questions, they can follow up with me. And that's another thing, Craig. Anybody that wants to email me or call me, feel free to do so. I mean, I'll talk to anybody. I'll answer any questions. You know, my time is a little bit limited sometimes, but I will get to you at some point. So anyway, long story short, China cannot compete on the world stage with their currency shackled to the dollar. They need to do everything they can to keep extending credit to keep their Ponzi scheme going. If they don't, you know, the whole thing comes down. So that's why I think that China needs to be pegged from the dollar.
Fair enough. I want to thank you now for being so generous with your time. We're already nearly a half hour into this. I got just a couple more questions left in queue, Brent.
Yeah.
One's a follow-up to that. This comes from Scott and just wants to know that if we have a currency reset, kind of like what Jim Willie talks about, how does that affect, you know, at the grassroots level, the balances on mortgages and credit cards? If there's a 30% devaluation even of the dollar, does the real cost of debt go up by 30% for individuals?
You know, that's a very good question. In a total reset, I think, you know, a reset would be a devaluation of the dollar in some form, right? I mean, that's the idea. So paying off the debt theoretically should be easier to do. It depends on kind of how they do it and how they structure it. My guess is that interest rates would go back up. I don't know what they – I think we're going to have to get into some kind of a – and I'm kind of jumping all over the place. I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me make sure I'm trying to answer this question appropriately. Long story short, it's hard to say. I think what they would do is they would reset it in a way that would make it easier for these currently outstanding debts to be paid off or, you know, forgiven or whatever it is. Going forward from that point, I would think that you know, interest rates would be higher, potentially substantially higher, because they would want to get off this zero bound. It kind of depends on why they reset. Okay, so we could get into a situation where there's a reset because so much money has been printed that all, you know, currencies are hyperinflating and, you know, it's just gotten out of control, and so they need to reset to something. It could also be a reset because we go through a massive deflationary event where everything, you know, the
collapse,
all the debt out there collapses, but the money is still owed. In other words, the dollar goes to 150, right, or something like that,
yeah,
where, you know, all assets, you know, just come down, but the and money is hoarded, and so the dollar goes through the roof, and so all those debts are still owed, but then they're wiped out because of a default, right? So it can either default because they just don't get paid, or they can default because they get inflated away. And so I think it depends on which outcome that is, what happens. Now, I think what's going to happen, and I could be wrong on this, I think what's going to happen is we will eventually have another big deflationary event where stocks will fall, real estate will fall, you know, debt will start to collapse. And that's when the central banks will come out again. And if you think they've printed a lot now, you just wait. You know, they'll do QE, you know, 25 trillion or something.
Yeah.
Right. And Japan will do the same and Europe will do the same. And that's when, you know, you get into the hyperinflationary scenario.
Yeah.
But I think for that to happen, I think there needs to be a currency crisis. And I think the currency crisis gets started by a strong dollar. So I don't know if I answered that question right or not, but if that person wants to reach out to me, I'd be happy to dig through it in more detail.
That's a good segue to the last question I have waiting in queue from Jill, who just wants to know, well, what percentage of gold ounces versus silver ounces does your fund currently hold, or do you like to see individuals hold?
So right now in our fund, we have a 8% physical silver position. I would actually like to see it a little bit higher. I guess it's not higher right now just because of where we're at. We've come a long way in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't wanted to chase it higher. But that said, you know, if we come in tomorrow and silver could be at $23. So perhaps I'm a little behind the gun on that. But I think if people have, let's just use $100 as an example. You've got $100 to allocate to precious metals. I think 60 or 70 of that, I think at least 50% should be in physical gold. I would say 10 to 15% of that should be in physical silver. And then the other kind of 20 to 30% should be, you know, in the mining equities.
And you own those too, right? You've probably been playing along in this in the miners this year.
We've had an amazing, the most bullish thing I've seen this year. And I do think we're due for a pullback, by the way. And I hope I'm wrong, but you know, with the way the COT is structured right now, I think everybody, whether you're long gold or whether you're short gold, should be prepared for a $100 move against them. Just based on the extreme, extreme positioning of the COT.
Yeah.
But yes, the most bullish thing I've seen this year is that outside reversal day to the downside and then back to the upside that the miners put in late January. I think it was like January 20th. It was right around the day that I sent out my most recent presentation. You know, the mining stocks were down like 9 or 10% that day and volume was flat, and it just didn't make any sense that they were down. And then, you know, the very next day they kind of rocketed back up to even. And since then, I mean, they've just been on a tear. I think they're up 100% since then.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think that's what you will see. You know, when the turn, you know, when you look back on this years from now and you see the turn, it will be because the miners started outperforming the bullion. And that's what we've seen so far.
And we are definitely, that's one of the big changes we've seen this year. Yeah, besides breaking out of the
absolutely,
and boy, to have the miners.
Well, no, you've seen, rather than the rallies being sold, you've seen the dips being bought. You know, gold has been extremely, extremely strong in the face of an incredibly negative cost structure. You've done a lot of great work on that. So, you know, I'll leave it to you to kind of explain that to people. It's definitely encouraging. I would say this, regardless of what happens over the next 6 months or the rest of the year, I think if you'd have told all of us at the beginning of the year that we could have gold at 1200 and the miners up 40 or 50% by May, everybody would have taken it, right?
Yeah.
And we're higher than that. We're higher than that. So, and all of any doubts that people have had over the last 3 or 4 years or any of the fears or any of the, gosh, how did I get this so wrong? You know, memes that have gone through your head, you know, you can kind of put those aside because it doesn't mean that we're not going to have more pain ahead of us. We very well might be, but this is the last 3 or 4 months to me have just shown that when central bankers lose control, this is what's going to happen. And central bankers are going to lose control. They absolutely are. I don't know when that's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be next month or next year or 2 years from now, but they're going to lose control. And when that happens, gold and silver and the mining stocks are going to do incredibly well. And anybody who doesn't have at least a sliver of this in their portfolio to protect against that outcome is doing themselves, their families, anybody that they know a disservice. So I would encourage anybody who doesn't already have the exposure to get it. And anybody that has the exposure, just hold on for dear life because it's probably going to be scary. But if you hold on, you'll be fine.
Dude, I would suggest the way you pointed out that reversal in the miners back in January signaling that, you know, a sea change. When you talk about the central banks losing control, the way that the Bank of Japan was faded in early February when they announced NERP, you know, and the yen rallied 10% instead of selling off, the way the ECB was faded in mid-March when they announced NERP, I'd suggest maybe they already have begun to lose control. You know what?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's one thing I want to point out real quick. A lot of times when I start talking about how I think deflation is the primary force and we're not going to – that doesn't mean it's negative for gold. If you look over the last 5 years – you know, before the big smashdown in 2013, gold moved up on a number of deflationary signals and on a number of inflationary signals. Since 2013, the biggest moves, the big rallies that we've had, the bear market rallies that we've had, have all come during deflationary overall market sentiment. It has not moved on inflationary signals. Even this year, at the beginning of the year, the move from, you know, 1060 to 1250, and you got to realize gold has not gone anywhere in 3 months. Gold was at 1260 on February 15th, I think.
Yep.
So, you know, we haven't really gone anywhere since the middle of February. Well, the first 6 weeks of the year were incredibly deflationary for the rest of the world and for the other markets, right? And so that was just, again, where gold moved on deflationary signals, not inflationary signals. So I'm not somebody who says deflationary signals are bad for gold. It might be bad for gold, but it doesn't mean that it's bad for gold. Again, I got into gold for deflationary reasons. I want a counterparty, right, that's not going to default on me. So that's the beauty about gold. Whether you get there through the deflationary route or the inflationary route, you've got to have gold in your portfolio to protect, because one of these things is going to happen, because the status quo is not going to last. We're either going to have a massive default or we're going to have a massive inflation. And under either of those circumstances, gold's going to do really well.
Yeah.
Now, in the middle, I don't know what's going to happen, but the end game kind of ends up the same with gold doing very well.
Yeah. No, I hear you, Brent. And, you know, we're told all the time by the bubbleheads on CNBC and Bloomberg that the rising rates, the Fed's going to raise rates, and that's why gold is going down. Well, last time I checked, when the Fed did allegedly raise rates in the middle of December, gold was 10.50. So
exactly. I would love for them to raise rates. Bring it on.
Go for one, exactly. All right, my friend, that brings us to the end. That means it's time for the final four, just four quickies. As you head out the door, you can usually answer these in a one word or maybe a sentence real quick, but, you know, kind of fun. You know.
Okay.
As we mentioned earlier, and you pointed out as well, you live in the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area, so you might find these final four kind of focused on your geography. I lived in San Francisco for a couple of years, and I recognize it is probably the best Chinese food, Asian food you're going to find anywhere. What is your favorite Chinese restaurant in San Francisco?
House of Nanking.
Dude, I was there before it was the place. I'm like in 1990 when it opened, and I remember going there. The last time I was in San Francisco, I took my kids there to eat there. It is the best. You're absolutely
right. The best hole-in-the-wall restaurant in the world.
Sure is. All right, House of Nanking. Everybody write that down. All right, I would presume, I think it's safe to assume that you've made a trip to Napa every once in a while. When you're up there, would you rather spend the bulk of your time in the Rutherford/Oakville region, or would you head over to the Stag's Leap region for the day?
Wow, that's a good question. I would say, you know, a buddy of mine had just bought a place in Stag's Leap area, and it's pretty nice, but I actually really like the Rutherford-Oakville area, so that's where I would go.
Fair enough. All right, number three. I don't know if this is up to date as of after last night, but the data I found is that Steph Curry is currently sitting on 1,593 career three-pointers. Now, we got a little NBA playoff season left, and regular season will kick off again around Halloween. So by the time we get to the end of this year, what will be a bigger number, Steph Curry's career three-pointers or the price dollar price of gold?
That's a great question.
Thank
you. How many does he have now? 1293?
1593. Yeah. You got the playoffs. You got the first couple of months of next year.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to go with Steph Curry on this. I'm sorry, man. But he's I'm voting for Steph Curry for president, by the way. I'm not voting for either one of the other jokers. So I'm going to go with Steph Curry.
Fair enough. And lastly, everybody always likes this question. You and I are having lunch today at the House of Nanking. And I pass across the table an envelope that holds about 1,260 Federal Reserve notes. Your task is to either go out and buy 1 ounce of gold or about 74 ounces of silver. What are you going to buy?
Gold.
Fair enough. That's what I'm
buying gold.
Yeah,
me too. I'm buying gold. Sure thing.
All right.
Sure thing.
That's right. Now, Brent, again, please tell everybody your email address, your phone number, anything you can do to help out. I know you're working.
Yeah.
So where can they find you?
Yep. Yep. So you can go to www.santiagocapital.com. All it really is a landing page. It has my phone and my email on there. But my email is Brent, B-R-E-N-T, at santiagocapital.com. You can reach me at 415-699-8972. Just don't call me at 3 in the morning.
I promise I won't. Plus, we got the time change thing.
no problem. Seriously though, anybody that wants to call me, I'll try to answer any questions. Sometimes time gets limited, but I will get back to you at some point if you reach out.
Brent, you're the man. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I know I've gotten already the feedback through the questions tab of people saying, gosh, what a great guy, what a great guest. Thank you so much for your time.
I'm gonna see you at Dismal later this year, right?
I hope so. Boy, that'd be wonderful. That'd be great. What Brent's talking about is there's a golf course out in the middle of Nebraska in the absolute – if you find nowhere on the map, just look right in the middle of nowhere and you'll find it. But it's beautiful. And, Brent, that'd be wonderful. Thank you so much for your time and everything else. Yep. And you have a great rest of your day.
All right. Good luck, guys. Bye.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll do this again next week.